Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks once again for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Today, I want to talk about China in the news. I'd like to read just a few snippets of news items that caught my eye. First, the number of Chinese nationals crossing into the United States has exploded, and in the 2023 fiscal year, which ended last September, border officials apprehended over 24,000 Chinese migrants at our southern border with Mexico. That's a record high. That was over 10 times the arrests recorded in the previous year, 2022, and a more than 7,000% increase from the year before that. This influx has sparked national security concerns that some have been sent here by the Chinese government as spies. Duh, do you think? Here's another one. A Chinese software engineer was arrested last Wednesday for allegedly stealing artificial intelligence technology from Google while secretly working for two Chinese companies. And here's a third one. Can Chinese-made smart cars gather sensitive information about the Americans driving them? Federal authorities want to find out and establish just what potential national security risks are involved in these sensor-packed vehicles. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said Wednesday such cars are like smartphones on wheels, and they need to be investigated as automakers with close ties to the Chinese Communist Party seek to flood the world with their four-wheeled products. Raimondo told reporters, "These vehicles are connected to the internet. They collect huge amounts of sensitive data on the drivers, personal information, biometric information, where the car goes. So it doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out how a foreign adversary like China, with access to this sort of information, could pose a serious risk to our national security and the privacy of U.S. citizens." Now, I'm trying to reconcile these news items with the Biden administration's military telling us that the biggest existential threats to America today are white rage and climate change. I wonder where they would rank China on that scale of existential threats. I think after listening to today's conversation with my upcoming guest, you will agree with me that at least in terms of external existential threats, China is going to shoot right to the top of the list. So stay tuned and don't miss this conversation. Let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. People, I am very excited to have as my guest today, best-selling author, investigative journalist, and president of the Government Accountability Institute, Peter Schweitzer. Everything he writes goes straight to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Titles like Red-Handed, Clinton Cash, Profiles in Corruption, throw them all out, and perhaps the biggest hit of them all, his latest book, Blood Money, Why the Powerful Turn a Blind Eye While China Kills Americans. Peter Schweitzer, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Oh, great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on, and congratulations on your new book, which I think just today hit that number one slot in the New York Times bestseller list. Your connection to the Freedom Center actually goes back a long way. Do I understand correctly that David Horowitz gave you your first job out of college?
He was my first boss. Yes, that's absolutely right. I graduated from George Washington University in 1987, and I went to work for, it was called the Second Thoughts Project. And these were ex-leftists who had become conservatives, and it was headed up by David Horowitz and Peter Collier. And so I got a baptism by fire in a good way, and have admired David's work ever since. And he's an amazing, remarkable person.
Well, I'm sure that he feels that the feeling is mutual. You're the president of the Government Accountability Institute. What goes on there? What is your mission there?
A lot of it's research. You know, there are a lot of organizations and media outlets that focus on, you know, the constantly breaking news, constantly churning out product. We're a little bit different. I tell our employees that, you know, think of a lot of media outlets as the regular army. They need to show the flag constantly. Everybody needs to be aware of what they're doing and see them. We don't. We're more like the special forces. We only want people to hear about us when we do something really cool. So we do a lot of deep research, extensive research. All of my books are done by a research team of a dozen people or more. And we take usually at least a year, if not longer, to actually conduct the research. We do a lot of forensic accounting work, follow the money, so to speak. And we have a great time doing it. And we're blessed because we have supporters who believe in what we're trying to accomplish allow us to embrace that kind of model.
Well, you're doing amazing work there. We could spend a long time talking about each and all of your books, but let's talk about your two most recent ones, which are about China. When you wrote Red Handed, How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win, you said at the time that in your 25 years as an investigative journalist, it was the scariest investigation you had ever conducted. How does your new one, Blood Money, differ from Red Handed? And is this one even scarier? Because in my opinion, it is.
Well, I appreciate that. The first, I think, Red Handed was scary because it talked about how, you know, corruption had evolved. We think of corruption in America as, you know, some, you know, lobbyist paying cash to a politician or a politician trying to get some, government contract for a family member. What we laid out in Red Handed is the fact that China was actually the one now that was effectively bribing people. And the consequences were that China's interests were being advanced. So that was very scary. I think in Blood Money, it brings it, I think, even more home because, you know, it's very easy to say, well, what's happening in Washington, D.C. is distant. It doesn't really affect me. Blood Money really shows that a lot of the things going on in our country, the fentanyl poisoning, the violence in our streets, the social disruption and chaos that we're experiencing, the stuff that affects our real lives, even though Washington, D.C. is far away, is wrapped up in this as well. So I think in that sense, this book brings it closer to home than Red Handed did because it impacts our lives in a very immediate way.
Well, some people worry that we may be headed for war with China, but in Blood Money, you demonstrate very terrifyingly that we are already at war. But I think too many people, Americans don't really recognize or realize the kind of warfare China is waging. Can you explain what disintegration warfare is and why the ancient Chinese strategist Sun Tzu, who famously wrote The Art of War, why he's so critical to understanding the mindset behind the war that China is waging?
Yeah, I mean, the mindset established by Sun Tzu, which, of course, his books are required reading by all military officers in China, posited that the ultimate strategist is the one who beats his enemy without actually fighting him. And that's really the crux of what they're doing. China looks at, you know, America's ability to wage war and says, you know, yeah, we don't really want any part of that. We don't want to, you know, deal with aircraft carriers, tanks and missiles. So what they say is, look, what can we do and how can we undermine the United States without actually fighting it? How can we actually kill Americans? How can we sow social chaos? How can we tear this country apart, but have the veneer or the appearance that we are friendly or at least a partner? That's really what disintegration warfare is. That's a book that was written in 2010 by senior military officials. It's been embraced by the Chinese government as kind of their mode of operation. And when you look at what's happening in the United States and the fact that our leaders are not responding to it, that's kind of the current situation that we're in.
Peter, the Biden administration's military tells us that the biggest existential threats to America today are white rage and climate change. Where would you rank China on that scale of existential threats? Maybe in between the two, or do you think the Biden administration, do you think they're off target on that?
Well, I think they're way off target on that, and I think there's probably a reason for it. But, you know, here's a really novel idea. Why don't we look at the threats that we face and evaluate who's killing the most Americans? That would seem to be, to me, a pretty good metric to evaluate a threat. That's not to say that Russia's not a threat, but, you know, Russia's a declining power. China is an ascendant power, and China is involved in a series of activities that are actually killing Americans. And over the last 5 years, they've killed millions, millions of Americans. We suffer just from the fentanyl poisonings. We suffer more deaths than the combat deaths that we faced in Korea and Vietnam. We face that every year now in the United States. It's the leading cause of death of people under the age of 45. And as I lay out in the book, Blood Money, China is really running the fentanyl trade. People fixate on the drug cartels. The drug cartels are the junior partners. This is a Chinese-run operation from the precursors to the money laundering at the end and everything in between. And that is because China has this strategy of disintegration warfare that is designed to kill Americans and diminish our power.
Yes, that is just a mind-blowing section of the book, by the way, that chapter on China's involvement in the fentanyl trade. And the Chinese military have plans to deploy even more potent drugs against the United States as weapons, don't they?
Yeah, there's a drug called carfentanil. There are other drugs that are used by veterinarians as pain relief for large mammals. These are now being pumped into the United States as well. So fentanyl is only the beginning. They've created this conveyor belt from China up through Mexico into the United States that they control, and they're going to put any deadly product on it they want. It also includes, you know, products that wouldn't seem as dangerous, but China is now heavily involved in illicit marijuana grows in the United States. This is not marijuana, you know, that college kids were smoking in the 1990s. It's not the stuff that's legally available in a lot of states now. This is highly potent stuff. It could be laced with fentanyl. And these are being done. There are thousands of these in the United States, and they are overwhelmingly being done by Chinese nationals, many of whom are here illegally, financed by China. And it is part of this strategy of undermining the United States. They call it cognitive warfare. So it's dangerous stuff. It's also stuff that doesn't seem as dangerous, but it all has the same purpose, which is to undermine and weaken the United States. And I think based on the evidence, it's working quite well.
You point out that too many lawmakers in Washington are just ignoring the unrestricted warfare that China's waging and ignoring the fentanyl crisis because it's too lucrative for them to reframe the communist regime as a commercial partner. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah. And in some cases, it's not just the abstract or general notion that China is a commercial partner for the United States. It's a commercial partner for these political families. And some of these are perilously close to actually these illicit activities we've been talking about. So if you look at the Bidens, for example, you know, I first reported in 2018 that the Bidens had these commercial deals in China. We now know that they've received tens of millions of dollars from China. But what I point out in Blood Money is that in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel, they are the kings of fentanyl. They control most of the fentanyl that is coming into the United States and killing the American people. The Chinese gang that made them the kings of fentanyl, gave them the expertise, gave them the access, gave them the personnel to, you know, help create this conveyor belt, is a gang called UBG. It's headed by a guy named Zhang Anlo, who also goes by the name White Wolf. Well, White Wolf has a business partner that in 2017 sent the Bidens $5 million in a forgivable interest-free loan. That's a loan that the Bidens have not repaid. So let's just think about this for a second. I've thrown a lot of names and concepts here. There is one degree of separation between the fentanyl trade and the Biden family. That's how close it is. And so, you know, honestly, does Joe Biden want to have a national conversation about Chinese involvement in fentanyl? Does he really want to do something about it? No, he doesn't, because of this financial link that exists. And you can look at other people. Governor Gavin Newsom in California has similar types of entanglements with people involved with Chinese organized crime that are involved in the drug trade. He doesn't want to point fingers at China either. And this is a huge problem because it means we don't even have leadership to identify the problem to even begin to address it.
You mentioned Biden and Newsom, but are we talking about lawmakers on both sides of the political fence?
Yes, we are. The other one I would add to that list would be Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate. He's going to be relinquishing that position, but I think he's going to remain in the Senate. His family, meaning the family he married into, the Chow family, have a shipping business. And really, this goes back to 1993, when then-Senator Mitch McConnell, his wife Elaine Chao, and his father-in-law James Chao made a trip to China. And they were there as guests of the Chinese State Shipbuilding Corporation. As the name implies, it's a government entity. It also happens to be the largest military contractor in China. And the Chinese State Shipbuilding Corporation basically made a deal with the family saying, hey, we tell you what, you've got the shipping company. We'll build those ships for you. We'll finance the construction of those ships for you. We'll provide crews to man those ships, and we'll provide contracts for those ships to ship Chinese goods to the United States. The McConnell Chow family took that deal. It grew the business exponentially, so it's now a very large, successful shipping company. The problem is, if Mitch McConnell were to do something in the Senate that really angered Beijing, they could destroy the family business overnight. That's the kind of leverage they have over Mitch McConnell. So again, does Mitch McConnell want to do anything about this? No, he really doesn't, because it would risk the family's business.
You also have a chapter on how China's putting illegal weapons into the hands of felons and gangs across the country. I was largely ignorant of this, and I suspect most people are. Can you tell us how serious that aspect of our war with China is?
Yeah, so China has this history. You might remember in the 1990s of trying to smuggle in, then it was 2,500 fully automatic AK-47s into the United States. And they were actually trying to sell them to criminal gangs. It was disrupted by U.S. law enforcement. But flash forward to 2018, they came up with a new ingenious strategy. Instead of large AK-47s, it's a small device about the size of a quarter. It's called an auto-sear switch or a Glock switch. And what this device basically does is turn a Glock handgun into a fully automatic machine gun. Now, these devices are highly illegal in the United States. You can only get one with a federal permit. If you have a criminal record, if you're a felon, no, you're not going to ever be able to get one of these. But in 2018, China mass-produced them and started smuggling them into the United States by the thousands. And according to ATF, they specifically were targeting criminal gangs and organized crime in the United States. They flooded into the country. And for that reason, over the last 5 years, we've had this massive increase in the rate of machine gun fire on the streets of America. In fact, I would challenge anybody, go on YouTube and you will find video footage of police cameras, police cars driving down the street in urban America, suddenly the subject of a hail of automatic machine gun fire that's coming from these Glock switches. So that's one of the reasons some of our cities resemble war zones. This is intentional by China, and it is part of this strategy to sow chaos and disruption in America.
Well, what about magnifying social chaos, which is the title of one of your chapters? How else, in what other ways, is the Chinese regime exploiting, we'll say, racial tensions in this country, for example?
Yeah, so this happens on a couple of levels. One level, what you would call the ground war, is we talk about some of the very radical Antifa-like groups that were very, very violent in 2020 and are now violent again with these pro-Hamas protests. These are actually pro-Beijing groups that are linked to China, FRSO, PSL, and they are designed really to push these protests to the extreme. So in 2020, if you were somebody who said, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about how the police are dealing with, you know, minorities, particularly black men. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to highlight this issue in a peaceful way. Well, standing shoulder to shoulder with you would be a member of one of these groups. Their message was not, hey, we need to make sure that reform is taking place. Their message was, all cops are racist. We need to abolish the police. This is a racist society. So they're making sure that these protests are more violent, more angry, and more extreme. The second part, though, if that's the ground war, is what I call the air war. And that's what's happening in social media. There are massive operations in China run by the Chinese military involving thousands of people. Each one of these people, in turn, will set up thousands of social media accounts in the United States posing as Americans. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of social media accounts that look like they are ordinary Americans. What these social media accounts do is basically half of them say America is a hopelessly racist, bigoted society. It can never be reformed. The other half of them are saying, I only like white people. I don't like minorities. Again, they're trying to create this impression of even greater social division and difference in our country than actually exists. So I would say, if there's anything optimistic in my book, I think you might come back with the impression that, yeah, we absolutely do have differences and divisions here, but perhaps they're being exaggerated online by China, because that is clearly their effort to do so. And I think they're being successful in that plan.
There are so many other aspects of China's war on the United States, which you write about in the book. I can't begin to dive into them all. You have a chapter, for example, on the Chinese Communist Party's foothold of influence in Hollywood. Another chapter on psychological warfare waged through video games sold in the United States. And then there is the insidious China-based social media platform TikTok. And your chapter on that, I think, is just jaw-dropping. Can you tell us a little bit about TikTok and the Chinese regime's goal of manipulating a country's values and identity through that kind of tool?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two aspects to this section. The first is to understand ByteDance, which is the company that controls and owns TikTok. This is a company that actually is physically not that far from the Ministry of State Security in Beijing. That's where the company is headquartered. And a lot of the senior personnel in this company are populated by, you know, former military, former Ministry of Propaganda, former CCP state media officials. That's who kind of guides this company. The company also has joint ventures with the Chinese Ministry of State Security, where they are actually studying how to manipulate people online. So this is the company that controls the content that tens of millions of young people in the United States are being exposed to. That's the first part. The second part of the section is really quoting Chinese officials, how they view TikTok, how they view it as a tool to manipulate young people in the West, how they are doing so right now. One military official says that TikTok is like a Trojan horse. Other military officials talk about how you want to deconstruct the identity that young people have as part of a nation. They talk about the need to get young people to reject national symbols. Think about all the things that are going on with statues and the flag. And this is part of China's strategy. They view it as an important gateway, because once you get young people, this is their words, not mine, to reject these connections, it's now very, very easy to get them to embrace the values that you want to push. And they also lay out what some of those values are. And those values are distinctly anti-Western, very much in line with what the CCP pushes. And they're also mindful to make sure that these values are subtly introduced to young people. They very much recognize that you want to appeal to young people and social media on an emotional level, because if you appeal to their emotions, they believe that this is their own righteous indignation. They own it. And now you can really manipulate them and steer them in the way that you want them to go. It's absolutely frightening. And again, these are their words, not mine.
Another thing I didn't know about, another aspect of your book, you write about the Chinese billionaires who are funding radical transgender groups in America. That was completely new to me. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, this was, I think, probably the biggest, whoa, what was that I just uncovered? I didn't see this coming at all. But yeah, there are two China-based billionaires who are pouring tens of millions of dollars into trans causes in the United States. One of them is a guy named Roy Singham. He's actually an American. He built up a company called ThoughtWorks. He then sold it to an investment fund that's partly owned by the Chinese government. That made him a billionaire. And then he promptly moved to China, where he lives now. He's very pro-CCP. He has friends that are high ranking in that Communist Party. He's very sympathetic to their cause. He has put $161 million into radical causes in the United States over the last couple of years. That includes these trans causes. The other billionaire was really surprising to me is Joe Tsai, who is the co-founder and current chairman of Alibaba, which is the Amazon of China. This is a company that is effectively a state-owned company. But Joe Tsai has been very sympathetic to the CCP. He certainly relies on them for his business, but he also, I think, genuinely believes the CCP is this wonderful organization. He has donated tens of millions of dollars to the cause of medical research on transgenderism and also the causes. What's curious in terms of why these guys are doing it, they're not trans themselves. There is no evidence that I've seen that any close family member is trans. But I think the kicker here, Mark, is that they're funding all of this research and this cause in the United States. They're not doing that in China, where I think by any objective measure, this cause, people who are transgender, people who are part of the gay movement, certainly face a lot more repressive environment in China than they do in the United States. But these billionaires are not supporting this cause in China, which leads me to believe that they view this as a mechanism of social disruption in the United States.
You have a chapter on the COVID pandemic, which is one of the most enlightening few pages I've read about China and COVID. Can you briefly, I mean, you've got a lot of information and detail in there, but can you touch briefly on how China socially engineered that pandemic?
Yeah, you know, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that this was a lab leak. It could have been an intentional leak, but it was probably a lab leak. We'll say that. But as I point out in the book, they knew about this in November of 2019. They also knew that it was transferable from person to person in 2019. They lied about it until the end of January. Now, what does that mean on a practical level? The problem is during that 2.5 month period, they basically cornered the market on PPE medical supplies. I'm not talking about the kind of silly cloth masks that they were telling everybody to wear. I'm talking about the actual medical masks, the K95 masks that medical personnel were supposed to be wearing. So they bought it all up. They vacuumed it all up from the West. So when they finally told us at the end of January, oh, by the way, this is transferred from person to person, there was nothing available and we were caught flat-footed. That and a series of other actions that China engaged in were really designed, I think it's pretty clear, to maximize the body count in the United States. One senior CCP official I quote talks about COVID as a form of unrestricted warfare. And it's pretty clear what their objective was. The problem is on the American side, based on the emails we obtained from Tony Fauci and others, the U.S. side was not interested in calling them out on these actions. In fact, the default position seemed to be, well, we don't want our Chinese colleagues to be blamed for this. So they effectively covered it up. So it's a dramatic example of this incredibly self-destructive behavior we have among our leaders, while China is literally killing Americans and is responsible for their deaths.
Yeah, self-destructive indeed. I just cannot emphasize enough what a riveting read this book is and how enlightening it was to me about so many different aspects of our conflict with China. I can't recommend it highly enough, but I ain't going to lie, Peter, it's scary. This nation is in trouble. Are you optimistic that we can reverse course and defend ourselves against China's disintegration warfare, or is it game over?
Well, I once had a conversation with a gentleman who was in the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam, and I asked him what it took to survive, because obviously he got out. And he said, well, Peter, the optimists died first because they thought they were going to get released in 2 weeks. Okay, 2 weeks went by, it'll be another 2 weeks. They quickly died of a broken heart. He said the second people that died were the pessimists because they were like, well, I'm never going to get out of here. And they died, although they lasted longer than the optimists. I said, well, then you survived. How did you survive? He said, because I was a realist. I accepted the fact that I may never get out, but my job was to stay alive every day and do everything in my power to make sure that I could survive. So if the chance was to get out, I would still be here. And that's kind of where we have to be. We have to be realists in this situation. There are too many, I think, on our side, Mark, I don't know if you agree with this, that are so dejected and convinced that all is lost. I think that's exactly what the enemy wants. You can't adopt that posture because the other side then is going to win. So you have to be realistic, realize the threat, but then say, what is in my power to do? And there are things that we can all do. We can communicate to our leaders. We can elect better leaders. We can inform and educate the people around us as to what's going on. There are steps that we can do to make sure that we survive and actually win this thing.
That is great advice. Peter, I think the work you're doing is among the most vital of any pundit or journalist or intelligence analyst working today. Where should people go to keep up with what you are doing?
Well, we have a podcast of our own. It's called The Drill Down. You can go to thedrilldown.com. You can go to my website, peterschweitzer.com, and you can find updates there on the research and the work that we're doing. And we always appreciate inputs. We have a tip box at the Government Accountability Institute website. If there's something you want us to look into, please send us tips. We do check it regularly, and we've actually gotten some very great leads by doing so. So please communicate with us.
Fantastic. Peter Schweitzer, thank you, sir, for coming on The Right Take. Please keep up the incredible work.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Listeners, get a copy of Blood Money by Peter Schweitzer. If you don't read this, you cannot call yourself informed. And thank you for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And again, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.